Hi, everyone. This is More Podcast, Less Process. I'm Jefferson Bailey at Metropolitan New York Library Council, and I'm here with...
Josh Ranger with AV Preserve.
Good morning, Josh. How are you?
I'm okay. It's Mardi Gras, and you scraped me off the floor from the bar early this morning, and so I'm looking forward to getting back, but I'm also looking forward to talking to our guests.
Yeah, well, you do your best work hungover, so...
It's true.
So I'm not sure what number podcast this is, because we've lost count of what episode number we're on.
We are epic.
Yeah, right. Or just, yes, forgetful, maybe. But we're very excited for our guests this week, and we will let them introduce themselves, which is always the easiest way for these things to happen. So go ahead.
Hello, I'm Bonnie Marie Sauer. I'm an archivist with the National Archives at New York City.
And I'm Kevin DeVorsey, and I'm a supervisory electronic records format specialist at the National Archives.
Excellent. So obviously we're here talking to our favorite NARA representatives. So, you know, one good question to start with, I think, is to sort of talk about, you mentioned National Archives at New York City. I think some listeners might not be familiar with the fact that there is a location of NARA here in New York City. So tell us about NARA New York.
Well, it's funny. That's one of the questions I always get when I'm at a meeting. I say, with the National Archives, and you came up from D.C. for this? And no, there's an office in New York City. So yes, the National Archives does have regional offices that house the records that are created by federal agencies in different areas. So the New York City office does holds the records for New York, New Jersey, Puerto Rico, and the Virgin Islands.
Yeah, well, we are right next to the Virgin Islands, so
yes.
that makes...
Yeah. Rather conveniently located.
Right. So how does that interplay work with the sort of national branch? Obviously, I guess there are things in the New York region that end up going to Archives 1 or Archives 2? Does everything come to the regional office?
Well, there is a division in that cartographic materials all go to A2 and photographic collections go to Washington. But then the general records of the branch agencies located in the different regions come to the regional archives.
Right, so it's mostly paper-based textual records that are held by our office.
Right. And do you work sort of directly with the local agencies? How does that sort of relationship work?
In some respects, yes. When they're retiring records to us, we might work with them to get better intellectual control of the records as they're transferring them to us. But mostly there are appraisal archivists who are in other areas, other offices around the country that work with the agencies more directly than we do.
So what you're talking about, these records and these agencies, and what is this stuff? Like what is it that you're actually doing?
What is the National Archives?
Yeah. What is the National
Records
Archives
Administration? Yeah. I guess that's maybe the first question.
Yeah. I think that's a really fundamental thing, is describing the organization that we work in. Bonnie is an archivist and works in research services and has custodial responsibility for the collections. I work in, if you think of National Archives and Records Administration, I work in the part of NARA that is the Records Administration part. We've gone through a transformation over the last few years, and so we're now known as Agency Services, and so we work directly with federal agencies. I'm actually in the part of NARA that does policy, specifically records management policy around electronic records. My physical location in New York is kind of secondary. The teams that I work with and my boss are located in Washington, D.C. But that's kind of a reflection of NARA itself. And we have regional archives located around the country, but we also have federal record centers because we have that responsibility for the entire life cycle of records. And I believe, last time I looked at the Record Center website, there's something like 17 record centers around the country. And the people that work in those are part of Agency Services as well. So we're kind of accustomed to having distributed teams and staff around, and so we're very good at things like web conferences and things like that.
And so what determines whether a collection is held sort of at a regional office or at A1 or A2, which is the two main archives in DC, or at FRC? Like, how does that determined? That's a FRC being Federal Record Center. We're just going to like spew acronyms basically the entire podcast. So if you don't know it, then I'll Google it or something.
Well, the Federal Record Center, that would be, it's kind of like a storage unit for federal agencies. Lawyers' offices, corporate offices will send their records off-site once, you know, they're not active anymore. So it's the same concept for federal record centers. And a lot of those records will be temporary. They'll be destroyed at some point. Only about 3% of records that are created by federal agencies come to the National the archival operations of the National Archives. So there's those other records that are created. They'll go to the Federal Record Center for a little bit and then be destroyed according to their retention schedule. But so whether the records go to DC, A1, A2, or to New York, it's based on where the creating office was. So the creating office is in New York or New Jersey, Puerto Rico, or the Virgin Islands, they'll come to the New York office. So it's a lot of headquarter records in A1 and A2, mostly, the larger offices.
And then, as I mentioned earlier, there are all those special collections of photographs, cartographic material, and then electronic records all go down to A2.
So do you get in like big shipments, like giant shipping containers of papers from Puerto Rico, or what? how do people send you things?
Just these massive crates come in. Yeah.
Just a barge. Yeah. They float up a barge.
Yeah, that's why we had to move our office so it could be closer for dropping off records. It's a fine-tuned process. There's an annual move. There are records the permanent record transfer happens once a year. Basically, it's a process where 6 months ahead of time, we find out what records are going to be coming to us and do checks to make sure that they were scheduled correctly, that they are what they say they are, that we have enough information to take them into our holdings, and then we take them in. We do have a lot of direct offers. The barge story isn't that far off with that. we just had a direct offer from the courts in the Virgin Islands, so a huge number of records came over. It was some Federal Record Center people going down there and boxing them up and figuring out the shipping and getting them over to us. So, but I should say they actually don't come to our office in New York City most times. The Federal Record Center that's associated with our office is in Lee's Summit, Missouri. So a lot of the agencies in New York and the surrounding areas will retire their records to the Federal Record Center in Lee's Summit, Missouri. And there is archival space out there that's temperature and humidity controlled in caves. So once the records are accessioned, they'll move them over to the archival space out in Lee's Summit, Missouri, and then we interact with the records through the archivists that are out there and provide access in that way.
So that's a really long trip then to retrieve something for a researcher, isn't it?
Yeah, I get crazy hours someday, but just get in the gov car and go. No, we ship them back and forth. That ship the records back and forth, so nobody has to take a car.
Okay. And people are complaining about NYPL moving stuff to New Jersey.
So you mentioned a relocation in one of your previous comments. So I know that the local NARA branch switched office locations recently. Tell us about that. Tell us about your beautiful new facility.
It is a beautiful new facility. We moved in November 2012 to the Alexander Hamilton U.S. Custom House down in the Financial District. It is a gorgeous building. It's nice to walk up in the morning. I work there. That's lovely. Moving from your nondescript government building in the West Village, which had its certain charms, but it's much more visitor-friendly. We have a lot more traffic from international visitors, and it really exposes the National Archives to a wider audience, so it's nice.
So that's something that's actually really interesting to me, talking about visitors and people coming there and using it. Because I grew up out west, and to me, the federal government is D.C., or it's, those pencil pushers and jackbooted thugs who are trying to stop us from doing what we want,
where are they located?
They send them all out west to get us. And so you know, that's really, like, growing up, like, it was kind of this distance, like that's not anything I can have access to or anywhere that you go. It's just like there's some kind of shrine and there's the Constitution and, you know, that's it. And so what, I mean, what does access look like? Like, what kind of visitors do you get? What do people come and what can they do?
Well, the kind of casual visitor, there is a welcome center that people with an exhibit, so the visitors get that experience as well. Some of them do pop in and start doing research, mostly genealogy. We have partnerships with Ancestry.com and a couple other, I don't know what to call them, but other partners, so that people can do genealogy research. You can search census, look for passenger arrival lists, and petitions for naturalization that show the process of how, you know, some ancestor naturalized, and has a lot of good, juicy details of the family on there. So a lot of people who just pop in do that. But we also have a lot of court researchers and scholars that come in to look at those records. But the more casual visitor gets the experience of having some kind of immediate connection to the records.
Yeah, I had a group from around the world just meeting in our space for a conference for a week. And on the last day, we ended around 4:00. And one of the people attending the conference went across the hall to the research room and was able to discover, I think it was a driver's license, something from Minnesota. And she had been doing genealogical research in other places, but had success in our office. And that was a total, she had an hour to kill and went in and was successful.
So maybe it's worth telling people a little bit about your day-to-day jobs. It sounds like you're obviously working somewhat different. Research services, electronic records management, so... maybe just give people a sense of what that's like at NARA.
As I said, I work in agency services, and specifically I'm in the part that does electronic records management guidance, and our official title is policy analysis and enforcement. And
so enforcement, I like that.
It's a jackboot of thugs.
Records management thugs.
In our hierarchy, there are three teams. One does electronic records kind of general guidance, and that's the social media guidance that you saw in the capstone guidance around email that came out recently. My team is responsible for the transfer guidance and metadata guidance associated with the transfer of records and other things at that point in the life cycle. There's a third team which actually does inspections, and that, I guess that's the enforcement side, and it sounds intimidating, but actually it's more of a collaboration with agencies, helping them understand what their responsibilities are. And, you know, records management is complicated, and so a lot of times it's very helpful just to be able to go and point out what's going on and help agencies improve. So in my world, a lot of time is spent learning how things work at the National Archives. It's an amazingly complicated institution. And so to put out good guidance, you really have to understand not only the ramifications for federal agencies, but the down the road ramifications for the other parts of the archives and the archivists in Bonnie's side of the shop.
Yeah, that's a good point.
And then, yeah, my side of the house.
Is he really passing this along, these considerations?
Yeah.
is that evident?
I will walk into his office.
I will say that, you know, I formerly worked at A2, and I was able to move to New York, but it's been very useful to be in close proximity with actual paper archivists, even though I deal with electronic records. Because if you've been to Archives 2 in College Park, it's a very large facility. You know, it's got to be a quarter of a mile long, and I spent a lot of time wandering between meeting rooms. But I just, for physical location, I didn't spend a lot of time in the research room seeing how people work. And so having access to actual archivists and being able to ask questions and see how they work, it's been very beneficial for me in, you know, kind of understanding the processes that are involved in accessioning records and describing records. So it's useful.
Yes. And I will say it has been helpful to have, you know, somebody from who's kind of working on these national teams in our office, because the regional offices tend to be, or in how NARA was formally structured tend to be very isolated, and you didn't know what was going on at the main office except that you all of a sudden got directives and you had to make certain numbers. So I think having that kind of collaboration has been interesting for our office, and just, you know, much more opening of what we do and how we look at what we do. So it's been positive from our end as well. I've been trying this whole time to think of what I do on a given day. Not to say I don't do anything. I mean, really, there's no day that's the same. It's a little bit of everything. You're managing teams of volunteers and interns that are working on processing projects or description projects. For us, because our records are offsite, we only have 5,000 cubic feet of our records. And I shouldn't say only, I mean, but there's 5,000 cubic feet of records on site of a collection that's about, I think, 147,000 cubic feet at this point. So, and managing the records between the three other locations and trafficking them back off on site, it takes up a bit of your day to keep that flowing. And also, you know, when you're looking at a series that is 25,000 cubic feet large, you don't process the whole thing. When something comes on site, a court case, for example, will come on site, then we process that. So your priorities and what you're doing every day changes based on the flow of what's happening in the office while trying to meet the larger objectives of what we're doing, trying to digitize more records to make them immediately accessible to people, kind of more of our high use case files. We're doing more of that. It's kind of more a push with the National Archives to have more immediate access for researchers.
Yeah. And what are some of those high-use collections or unique or notable?
Let me think. So I'm trying to think of the ones that we just did. There's the... we just did a lot of Beatles work. John Lennon case for... That one was... what it was. So there was a John Lennon case, there was George Harrison case, that one was for copyright infringement for My Sweet Lord. Reading through these transcripts, though, is kind of the fun part for me, listening to John Lennon talk about the process, well, not listening, but imagining in my head with John Lennon, his words coming to life, talking about the process of creating music and, his opinion on, you know, celebrating his own birthday randomly comes up in a court case. So it's those kind of neat little treasures that come up that, I don't know, brighten my little day.
You know, as somebody that was new to New York walking in and kind of learning this, there's the Titanic court case after the sinking of the Titanic and the Rosenberg trial and things like that. That's like, it never occurred to me. Of course those are here. Those are the court case over the sinking of the Titanic took place in New York.
Yeah, a lot of mobsters. I've been working with a lot of mobsters lately.
Yeah. Don't talk about your coworkers like that.
You mean their records.
And, to go off on a slight tangent, what Bonnie was saying about reading the transcript and imagining John Lennon's voice, that's one of the things that I've had to learn. We just released transfer guidance, and we've included categories for electronic records such as audio video material. And I've been called into meetings with federal agencies asking about video formats and have wondered, well, what have you been doing up until this point? And there was that, well, we had a committee meeting and we've always just viewed that paper transcript as the record of that meeting, right? But we've been shooting video for years and years and years, and now we'd kind of like to substitute that video. So in some agencies, things are on the very bleeding cutting edge. In some agencies, there's kind of a lag in time between when a technology is adopted and they view that as the permanent record. So it's an interesting shift that's taking place.
Right, and that technology itself has a finite lifespan or use window. How do you build that into the transfer guidance?
Well, and that's why I say, every day I learn more. Because there are, you kind of come in and think, oh, everybody's using these technologies. The more exposure I get to the actual schedules that are written by agencies, you kind of see these different retention periods in play. And so it has been common for agencies to hold on to records for 25 years. So on one hand, some agencies are presenting us with electronic records that are in brand new formats, but we're also still getting mainframe data off tapes in EPSIDIC or ASCII. So we have to kind of account for this 40-year span in electronic records and be, you know, looking to the future, but also cognizant of the past, which is challenging.
Yes.
I would also think that there's a challenge in which technologies the agency actually decides to use. I did a project with the Defense Media Activity, which included combat camera and some stuff at the Pentagon. And that office there at the Pentagon, they had to have a policy of, well, we'll accept any format. Like, we don't know what they're going to be, what video format they're going to be using out in the field. So we have to accept everything. And so, you know, like Adobe would put out a new standard for one of their formats, and then they'd have to say, oh, now we have to accept that one and like figure out how to take care of it. And plus all the past ones too.
That is one of the great challenges that we face, is if you pick a format, no matter how obscure, there's probably a federal agency that's using it. literally, I get presented with emails from appraisal archivists or records officers asking about, what about this format? And I've learned, you know, the series of questions that you have to ask, because just because an agency's using a format with records doesn't mean that they're permanent records. And it's pretty common that you'll encounter some strange format, but there's also a PDF of the same file. And so you learn to kind of poke a little bit further to try and win out, is this format really a problem for NARA, or is it just something an agency, the records officer needs to communicate more clearly with their IT staff to figure out what's going on?
Yeah, and you mentioned permanent records there. So how, sort of walk us through how things operate within retention schedules and then are appraised as permanent records. What's the sort of dynamic there? That's a hard one.
Well, yeah, and I'll
and this is, I guess, a broader appraisal question, but obviously you work directly with agencies to do retention schedules, very records management, and some of that material also then becomes part of the permanent collection. Hypothetically?
And I'll kick out my disclaimer at this point, you know, saying that I'm not an archivist, and so I do work in the records management side of NARA, but I'm not an appraisal archivist, and so I'll give my view of how things work. And I said, you know, you ask these questions of agencies to try and figure out what's actually going on, and one of the first questions is, are these records scheduled? You know, that's a fundamental thing. Have you looked at these and looked at your file plan and see where they fit in? So do you know that they're permanent, or is it just you have this system and you're worried about it because you know it's not in compliance? And so that, you know, there is that schedule writing, identify, is there an existing schedule, or does a new one need to be written, or does it fall under a general record schedule? And then there is the you know, we have appraisal archivists that work with records officers to help them craft these things and determine the appropriate retention period for records. Ultimately, the archivist of the United States signs off on these schedules, and then they go into effect. Does that answer that question?
Yeah.
That's my high-level view of how things work.
Bonnie, any thoughts on that?
I guess the only thing I would add is that the retention schedules change. So something like our civil case files, they used to have a 20-year retention, and now that's a 15-year. So it changed how quickly we get records, which has been interesting on our side of the house, just of, you know, more privacy concerns and issues like that might come up for us that we have to think about with a quicker turnover of getting records.
And what are some of the challenges in the research services side?
In terms of?
Oh, you know, new record formats, appraisal issues, larger collections, new researcher types of requests. Like, do people have?
Well, and I know, you know, internet technology and computerization are wonderful tools, but there is that expectation that everything's online. And so that's one thing that NARA is focused on, is providing access to records, but it's not always easy. There's a lot of work that has to be done, and that's one thing, seeing the work that Bonnie does in processing collections, and I'm always asking her questions, you know, if there's an electronic court case, what's the unit there? Is it the different parts of the court case? Is it the court case? to help make good decisions on the electronic side, and seeing how they deal with it on the paper side is very, very useful to make sure that you're worrying at the right level.
Yeah.
Well, and to speak further than that, it's exactly that expectation that everything is going, that you can just search and everything will pop up. I get that question a lot when you go out and say, I'm an archivist and I work for the National Archives, and you know, somebody who works at somewhere at like a corporate office will say to you, like, well, why don't you scan everything? It's like, no, because
scan there all 4 billion documents or whatnot.
I believe it's 10 billion.
10 billion.
I feel like we're like the McDonald's golden arches. We need that outside, just continually flipping. But you know, there is a lot of work that goes into before you actually digitize a case file, for instance, because the courts don't retire it to you in a way that where all the documents are in the order they're supposed to. So you have to do a lot of arrangement, and some of these cases will be 25 boxes and going through, and then you get to the part of scanning. And so it's not, yes, we can have that feed tomorrow. You know, there is a process involved so that in order that the records make sense when, you know, it's a durable way of people being able to look at them in the future.
Yeah, I know that a lot of focus is on data sets and big data, and you've had experience doing research down at A2. And that's one of the challenges, since not every electronic record that we receive has that kind of big data attachment to it that is ready-made for people to do innovative searching across. That's one of those things that we're thinking about. How can we bring in electronic records in a way that makes it amenable for that kind of search?
Yeah. And that sort of, I guess, begs an original order question. So, I mean, you mentioned obviously some accessions that you'll get have a very predefined structure and might adhere to records management policies at the agency or department before they arrived. And I'm sure you have sort of backlog or older collections that might have internal structures which are difficult to understand, are to which the code book might have been lost, or exist somewhere in in print format, but not sure where. So it'd be interesting to hear from the processing side how you deal, especially because some of these collections are huge, I imagine.
That's one of my favorite things. Where you're looking at paperwork that's 50 years old that says it's arranged by whatever decimal classification system. You're like, and could I have the code book for that? Thank you. Luckily, a lot of them do have the description with it. So it's a laborious process then of going through and making detailed folder lists or something. But providing access in that is challenging because it's not an intuitive system, except for the people who were working 50 years ago, but they're like 56.2. I know exactly what that is.
Right.
So making that intelligible to the public is a challenge, but it's one we're happy to do.
Right.
What about privacy issues? And I know I've seen this in other agencies, just the issue of confidential stuff or the, I forget the term now, but I guess releasing things. Yeah, releasing things, that, reviewing them before releasing them. So is that something that you're dealing with here as well?
Absolutely. The largest collection for us in the New York offices are Chinese Exclusion Act files. So we do need to screen those to make sure that there's nothing about, about minors or personal issues, health issues. So that does get screened and redacted. What's been kind of interesting to me is that, if something was in the Chinese Exclusion Act file that states something about an individual, we would have to redact it out, particular information. But if the same information was filed in a court case, because that's filed in an open court, that we would not redact out. So there's the context of the way the records were created and how they were created that kind of stipulates when you pull information. So that's, I don't know, been a little interesting issue that I've been playing with in my mind lately.
And on the electronic side, we ask agencies to identify records that have privacy issues and any access restrictions. Sometimes it doesn't work perfectly, and so we screen electronic records for PII, personally identifiable information, and do our best. But it's one of those issues that I'm always, as a format specialist, looking at, how does this format actually store information? And what are the ramifications down the road? Because I live in fear, honestly, of creating a 1,000-year backlog for somebody in the future, having to pour through electronic records before they can be released.
Or not looking at the embedded metadata and having secret stuff in there that should not.
Exactly. Yeah. And that's one of the things. There's that idea of sustainability of electronic formats. But it's almost as important for us just to know how does that format work, regardless of its sustainability, so we know what to look for, so that we can work with the people that actually process records and say, this format isn't necessarily bad, but it can do this, it can store metadata in this way, and so you need to be aware of it and make decisions.
In some formats, I hear you can basically just embed any digital object in, thus leading to my next question. Uh-oh. Kevin, I saw your name on the recent PDFA report, so you want to tell us just a little bit about what that was? This is the NDSA report about.
Right, yep. And so that was Donald Chalfant, who's on my team, and myself representing the National Archives with people from the Library of Congress, Portico, and I believe Park Service, and we had some kind of people that floated in and out, but it was looking at a new version of PDF that was recently released, which is PDFA3, and one of the main differences with PDFA3 is, well, PDFA2 allowed you to create a PDFA document and attach another PDFA document. PDFA3 allowed you to attach anything, so any blob, any format, anything you wanted, you could upload into this PDFA document. So we were looking at it as, what are the ramifications for the National Archives? Would we recommend that agencies adopt this format? And then we had Portico from the publishing side and the Library of Congress, and so we were all kind of poking at it and doing our analysis and had discussions and brought in people who were responsible for the development of the specification, and came up with the report that came out, basically saying, not dismissing it, because there are use cases where it might be a good way to go, but it's something that we need to think long and hard about. And it is that idea of, if you have this perfect preserved layout of a document, but then you have this arbitrary content that's attached, what would NARA's obligations be? We would still be obligated to know if there's PII in that. And so maybe the answer is in how we process that. Do we have tools that could view that attachment and go through it in advance? Currently we don't. So it's one of those things we just want to be aware of what the possible ramifications would be.
Yeah, I think those are format challenges that a lot of people might not think of when they think of NARA taking electronic records, right? So, yeah, good story. Interesting use case.
I do you have much control over what formats people use, or?
My team has been responsible for releasing this new transfer guidance that came out in January. It is replacing guidance that was put up between 2002 and 2004. At that time, that guidance was developed as part of a presidential e-records initiative, and we were partners with federal agencies who self-identified what they considered to be the formats that they wanted to address. So there were six categories that they included. See if I can get these. Email, web records, PDF, geospatial, and scanned text, and digital photographs. I got it.
Nice.
And so, clearly that's a range, but it's not every kind of electronic record that is in use in the government. And so it was good guidance. It was very detailed in what the National Archives expectations are. But we ran into that problem of, since agencies were creating audio and video records and we didn't have guidance around it, they basically were able to do whatever they wanted. So we've come up with this new guidance, and part of it is, these are the things that the National Archives is comfortable bringing in. But there's also that educational component of, for agencies that are in a position and they are asking us questions, now we have answers for them. So is it always perfect? No. As we said, maybe 3% of the records in the government are permanent records. So it's not always clear that, oh yes, we'll get this system to do these records because they're permanent records. It doesn't always work that way. They're not always identified and scheduled as permanent until later on. So we're trying to be responsive and work with agencies and put out some realistic guidance that they can comply with.
What other NARA things are going on? I'd be interested to sort of hear. Obviously, David Ferriero has been the archivist of the United States for a couple of years now. There's new online initiatives like the Citizen Archivist Dashboard thing. I forget its exact name, but sort of crowdsourcing, you know, user engagement thing. What else is sort of happening in the broader world of NARA that you feel comfortable talking about and that you are supportive of?
I will say that, the agency services part, last year we came out with a presidential directive. Actually, we didn't come out with it. President Obama signed it, and it came out of the White House, and it is instructions to agencies to improve records management across the government. And that's been very exciting for us. I was in meetings last week with a large agency, and they were basically sitting down with their enterprise architects, their IT people, their general counsel, staring at the presidential directive and making plans, asking for funding, and so that they can implement what we have outlined in the presidential directive. So from the records management side of the shop, that's incredibly exciting. Part of the presidential directive, they're creating a position for records managers. And so that's kind of a customized job description that'll now be in place describing what a records officer should be at an agency. And that's cool. That's new and exciting as well.
Yeah. I'm just thinking there was a strategic plan for the National Archives that came out, or that we've been discussing, I guess came out last week. And kind of one of the points of it goes to something I said earlier, where the National Archives is saying that it's going to scan everything. But I think how that is interpreted and how we go about doing that, I'm hoping that it's more of a scan on demand thing going for what researchers are interested in, and setting up a system that will be able to just digitize and not necessarily a whole series at once, but maybe in a piecemeal way that makes what people want to see accessible at the moment, and then and create a system that we can kind of plug in as we move along. So that's kind of exciting. And
they've put that out as make access happen. And so, across the National Archives, we're all looking at what we do and how does that contribute to making access happen for researchers. And I know I've had this conversation with Bonnie, what are the steps that we need to take to responsibly make records available? And it's interesting to break it down in that way. So I think it's been a positive thing to have us all look at our jobs and think, what can we do better? How can we get more available? And then I turn around, what do we need to ask agencies for? What is Bonnie not getting when records come in the door that we can formalize in words that go out to agencies and hopefully improve the situation?
And I think of not only responsibly, but also durably, something that, so in 5 years, we're not redoing it, something that we continue just to build on and continue creating.
Yeah, and that's a challenge for sort of large scale digitization, right? I mean, it's easy to scan something, but it's not necessarily easy to manage it or serve it up after that.
Exactly, yeah. And I should say, you mentioned the Citizen Archivist dashboard, mm-hmm. that is an online portal where you can do kind of crowdsourcing. But the regional offices have kind of taken that and have localized little Citizen Archivist programs, which will be one that I'm hoping to start up soon. That really gives the public the opportunity to be an archivist for a day and get an appreciation for what goes into making records accessible in the course of like arranging and describing and then digitizing that. So that's kind of fun. I'm eager to get that started.
Yeah, and we haven't really talked about, just because you don't necessarily work in this area a lot, but outreach and education and other things that definitely the local branch does and obviously the agency does wide. So maybe talk about some of the efforts in that area for the New York office I mean, I'm realizing that they're not your responsibility, but obviously they're kids coming through the office all the time, so you must know that it's ongoing.
Absolutely. I mean, with the one of the draws of the new space was to be able to have a learning center where, you know, dedicated classroom space that we could have classes come through. So yeah, there's little ones running in and out, doing some kind of primary source research, getting that experience.
Pulling boxes off shelves, whatnot.
Yeah, just let them loosen the stacks. No, they created a little faux environment for that. It's lovely.
Should set them up with scanners.
Wait a minute.
Yeah, that's one way to scan everything. Children. Child labor.
National Archives does not endorse this. So there definitely is that. There, as I mentioned earlier, there's the Welcome Center with a little exhibit that it changes out quarterly. And so there's just a renewed effort. The space does allow us to have more programs. We also do professional development for archivists in the metropolitan area. We've hosted a few SAA workshops and also with the Archivist Roundtable. So that's been exciting. It's really opened up what we're able to do with the public.
Yeah.
And we also, you know, poach some Smithsonian visitors, make them come up. It's nice having that partner, being in the same building with another cultural institution, that, you know, kind of symbiotic relationship.
Yeah, definitely.
You don't have conflicts because you're different federal agencies, or
turf, I guess, they're wars.
They're not really an agency.
That was my first government job. they're federal. They're good people.
Yeah, it's been a nice relationship, I think. And we don't really poach their visitors.
The Custom House, one of the large tenants is the National Museum of the American Indian, but there's the U.S. courts, the bankruptcy court is the oldest tenant, and then there are other federal agencies, so it's a pretty good place for us to be.
Yeah, and it's a beautiful old Cass Gilbert building, so I certainly encourage people to go.
Yeah, come on down.
What other questions do we have? I know I said I was going to ask a Schellenberg question, but I might not, unless you guys want me to.
Thank you.
I demand a Schellenberg question.
Can you explain evidential and informational value, please? No, sorry. You don't have to.
Kevin's like, I studied.
I know
this.
We were actually talking about it before the podcast. I was like,
maybe I should ask a personal question. How do you process audiovisual collections?
And standard disclaimer, I'm not in the custodial unit, but the National Archives does have a custodial unit down at A2, and they bring in all audio video records. One of the things I should have said at the very beginning, you know, I mentioned the complexity of the National Archives, but part of that complexity is, you know, we have different legislations governing how records come to us. There's the Presidential Records Act, and those materials wind up in presidential libraries with archival staff. And the part I work with is the Federal Records Act, which is, you know, the majority of plain vanilla federal records coming to the National Archives. We also have agreements with Congress where we take care of their records, and then the Supreme Court as well. So we have these custodial units with specialization in certain areas. And so I mentioned that because I know that we got the oral recordings from the Supreme Court, and they go to the same AV lab to deal with. The nuts and bolts, we still get a lot of videotapes, but we're also getting electronic files as well. If the schedule identifies it as an audio or video collection, it'll go to that custodial unit. If it's intermingled with other electronic records, it goes to a kind of general electronic records custodial unit.
And it's the same thing with the textual records. You know, it's really if the series is defined, if it's a photograph series or if it's audiovisual exclusive, then it goes to the unit. But something I love talking about, court records, but if in a court case, you will open a box and there's 40 cassette tapes of the trial transcript, the transcript basically of the trial, and then we have to deal with that. But working with the units down at A2 to preserve them and make them accessible. So yeah, we come across photos. One of my favorite things, coming across photographs or tapes or something different than just textual. A little difference, but yeah, so we will have some pocketed around, just like everybody opens the box and finds like, oh, I didn't know that was in there.
And you know, one important note is I mentioned the custodial unit that takes care of these things. We also have our labs, which, you know, it's total world-class facility to digitize materials, and that, you know, whether it's paper or tapes or motion pictures. And it gets a little, I hope I don't say anything that's off the reservation, but NARA is a federal agency, and so we do produce records, and we have to comply with our own guidance around records. So that in doing the transfer guidance, we worked with the custodial unit and the labs to see what are they doing format-wise, so that we made sure that we were accounting for what at least one federal agency was doing as well as the other ones, which is good. You know, they work very closely together, but it is great having that kind of world-class resource for very, very technical information around formats from the practitioner's point of view.
So when you encounter one of these collections that has multiple types of media and textual, obviously it has to sort of get broken up to be sent to different custodial units as far as preservation or digitization? Or how does that happen?
So for something like the cassette tapes that we found, we sent those down to the digital lab to have them converted to a format that we could provide access to. And then I believe the tapes were sent back to us to hold on to, I believe. I could be wrong. Sorry. But
we'll edit that out.
But we wouldn't pull out. Yeah, thank you. but we wouldn't pull out the photographs when I come across a photograph collection that's in our holdings. We wouldn't pull out those and then send those down. We'd leave them in. And,
okay.
Yeah.
Gotcha.
Yeah, back to the audio video. If you ever have the opportunity to go to Archives 2 in College Park and are allowed to take a tour of the labs, there's an amazing collection of old equipment that they keep on hand, you know, from the old early Edison recording devices and things like that. So they try and maintain the ability to go back in time, at least as far as they can.
They still have those big computers that take up a whole room. Is that like UNIVAC or something?
I haven't seen any of those, but we do have a computing center off in West Virginia that houses the electronic records.
I'm pretty much out of questions. Yeah. Do you have any other? What else? Do you have anything else you'd like to talk about? This is your chance to ask each other a question. Like, where's lunch after this
Body
interview?
I've been meaning to ask you. One thing, you know, Bonnie says it better than I do, but I've worked in a number of different institutions. I mentioned that NARA's by far the most complicated cultural institution I've ever been involved with, just because of the span going from temporary records and federal record centers to permanent records, to presidential libraries. There's a lot going on, and you need to understand it all. But one thing Bonnie always says is, I'll paraphrase, if you're intimidated by the scale, you're not going to be good. That's just a part of the job. So you kind of have to rely on what you've learned in your professional experience and not let the 10 billion pieces of paper stop you.
I think that's, I never thought I would work for a government institution. it wasn't really when I was going to library school and focusing on archives. I had this lovely romantic notion of working at a little historical society and reading diaries every day or something. But then life just takes you on a different course. And so I never thought I would work with a collection on this scale. And it's been one of the most challenging things that I've ever done, but it's also one of the most fascinating things to me. I mean, the having to think about not only the size of it, but also it being in four different locations where you're working with staff in all these different places, and how do you provide access and still provide do holdings maintenance and preserve the records? It's very, very interesting.
And your user is everyone.
Right.
There's no real defined user community. It's the American people.
Well, it's one of my favorite things, talking to people in smaller shops where, you know, it's like, well, you know, so it took about 6 weeks to get back to, you know, there's like playtime, like, you know, we get back within 10 business days to somebody. And, you know, you have to just keep going with it because if you let the backlog of research requests go, you'll never get on top of it. So, yeah, it's pretty neat.
Yeah, and that's what is a good decision when it comes to a collection that large? There are these fundamentals of archival science and records management that you want to, you know, what's intellectual and physical control mean when it's 10 billion pieces of paper? Is it different than a small archives? And so what are those good decisions that help us do our job? And so it's endlessly fascinating.
Fascinating, that is the word.
I really like that. I think that's great. I think it's applicable to smaller places too. I really think, you know, the work that I do coming into collections where it can be a warehouse full or it can be a closet full, but it still overwhelms people because they kind of see, oh, there's a bunch of tapes and films and I don't know anything about it and I don't know what to do, and so I'll just leave it there. And so it's true, like you can't get intimidated by that or intimidated by the fact that you have to make a decision and maybe 20 years down the road it will be the wrong one, but but yeah, but you know, I guess it is different when you're dealing on such a big scale, making those decisions that you can't worry about a single document kind of thing that you might make a mistake. But
exactly, you know. I think if I had the mindset I had now, you know, when I was working in places 10 years ago, like, it would have been so liberating. But
deaccession everything.
Well, and also document your decisions. It's not just, oh, it's one of Crazy Bonnie's decisions. It's like, this is why I thought that. People 20 years down the line, oh, can't wait to see what they think.
Cool. Yeah, we're about an hour, so that was great. That's good. Yeah. If you have any final thoughts,
how awesome
words
Mara
of
is.
Wisdom.
Come visit the U.S. Custom House.
Yes, definitely. I've been there. It's beautiful, and obviously great people are there. So,
thank you. Yeah, yes. I agree.
Thank
All
you.
Right. Yeah, thanks.
Hey, good podcast.